I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, and a warm welcome to everyone, everywhere. I'm Deborah Levy, and we are here to launch Lauren Elkin's incredibly enjoyable and clever book, number 9192, Notes on a Parisian Commute. Published by the small but mighty and beautifully named independent literary press, Les Fugitives, publishers of contemporary French writing in translation. In fact, they had to send me an extra copy of Lauren's book because my house guests made off with it. It's that sort of size, it sort of resembles a notebook. You can slip it into your pocket or into your bag. And I had to actually message them to say that just because it was written on a bus, they couldn't transport it out of my home, and I needed it for professional purposes. Lauren, their reply was they picked it up and they couldn't put it down.
That's amazing.
Lauren Elkin is the acclaimed author of Flaneurs, Women Walk the City, which was a Radio 4 Book of the Week, a New York Times notable book, and a finalist for the Penn Diamantstein Spielvogel Award for the Art of the Essay, and The Art of Ulipo, an attempt to exhaust a movement with Veronica Esposito. She is also an award-winning translator, most recently of Simone de Beauvoir's previously unpublished novel, The Inseparables, published by Vintage Classics recently. And then on a personal note, I have to say that I look forward to everything Lauren writes for many reasons, but most of all because I'm interested in what she notices. At its most simple and basic, I believe that is what all writing in any genre is about. Lashings of skill really helps, but being interested in how a writer thinks rather than how they plot a story is the difference between me wanting to pick up a book or not. I'm also grateful to Lauren for the critical apparatus she brings to her many reviews of the works of other writers, for her close reading of form, of the behavior of a stretch of writing, her attention to what might disturb or disrupt the calm surface of a text, the way she is not freaked out by ambiguity or enigma, and works hard for her readers in a most hospitable way. She is light on her feet, such as page 43 of the book we are discussing today, and I'm going to read one line from it. I never remember from one year to another how dark it gets in the morning in winter. I guess we forget it, like pain. So Lauren, welcome.
Oh God, you made me tear up. Thank you so much. That means so much to me, especially because I've heard you on several occasions say precisely that what you look for in a writer, or, you know, hope for in your own work is that there will be some kind of sustained interest in what they're going to say next and following, you know, the line of their thought. And I have strived for that. I've striven for that in my own writing, in this book that I've just finished the draft of, and in my revising of this book, slight though it was really to make sure that everything was very tight in a way that Deborah Levy would find compelling.
Oh my God. Well, you know, it is, I really hear your voice in this book. It's yeah. Is such a pleasure. So maybe tell us how you began this book, the task you set yourself when you began your commute to work on buses 91 and 92 between 2014 and 2015 in Paris.
Yeah. Well, it started really naturally because I am a just... I don't know what's the word. I'm a little bit nervous, and it's hard to make the transition from home life to Zoom life. I guess in general, but you know, especially when you have a small child in the house. So, just before we got started, as I just told you, Julian spilled a bowl of soup on my feet. So I'm speaking to you with soup in my shoes. So he's making. incapable of remembering words. Anyway, I really am a compulsive journal keeper. And when I am too busy to take out my Moleskine notebook, or Moleskine, as I was recently corrected, you are supposed to pronounce it, à l'italienne, I will just take out my phone, which, as is the case for so many of us, is never far from my hand, and open up the notes app and just jot down something that has occurred to me, something I've noticed, something I want to think about, or something that I can think about right there and then. So this book really was born out of that compulsion to reach for something to write with and just jot down what I was seeing or thinking. Or even, you know, I mean, the something that I think writers do, I do it, and I think other people do it too, is sometimes you're just kind of making up sentences in your head, like, you know, turning the world into sentences, just because that's, you've got a muscle that does that, and it's working even when you're not sitting in front of your computer. So it'd often be, you know, like, oh, I can't stop writing. I have this like graphomania. I've got to get the words out somewhere.
So that's
how it began.
Writing it on your phone, you're writing it in notes. I had a little go at writing notes, just, you know, inspired by yourself. It's quite hard. And you're on the 91 and you're on the 90, you're on your bus, and you write that instead of using your phone to escape from the world, you're going to use it to record the world.
Exactly.
So what happened when you were in mid-sentence and it was your stop and all of that?
I'd have to get off and finish my sentence, you know, right after I'd gotten off the bus, find a little place to tuck myself away and finish what I was saying.
And were you tempted when you transcribed it later to add things and to edit it?
Yeah, that was not part of the game. Yeah, because in the very beginning, I didn't know that it was a game or anything. I was just, you know, compiling all these notes on my phone. And soon it was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do every morning. I actually have a friend from a long time ago in Paris, Jennifer Dick. If she's out there tonight, she's a wonderful American poet who lives in France. And she used to tell me that when she got to the university where she taught in the morning, she'd get there early before the students arrived. She'd just sit at her desk and journal a little bit, like just to kind of clear the cobwebs and focus herself. So I think I wasn't thinking specifically of Jen's journaling practice, but now that I'm talking about it, it comes to me that I think that was, you know, on some level in my mind, I was thinking, well, I'm going to teach, I'm going to clear out the cobwebs. It was in the beginning just this kind of cobweb clearing exercise and this compulsive activity. But I think after a while, probably after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and I started thinking like, oh God, things are actually happening now. Maybe I should be like doing this with a little bit more care. Then I think I started taking more care in terms of the compositional strategy. But yeah, it was only about a year or so later that I started putting it together and thinking like, maybe this could be a book. I don't know. and I wouldn't let myself like change anything or add anything or fix anything. Yeah. There were like some typos or maybe some turns of phrase that were slightly unfortunate, but mostly so it's as it was.
The restriction suited you? Suited your thoughts? And like the motion of the bus and all of that?
I think that, yeah, that's very generative for me personally. I think for other people too, obviously for, you know, the Ulipo.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll come to that. Would you read an extract?
Yeah, sure. I'll read for maybe 6 or 7 minutes. Is that enough or is that too much? Is that okay? Okay, because I can scale back if it's too much. So I'll begin with the first entry, which is from the 22nd of September, 2014, Monday morning. Too early, it's too early. I hate morning classes. I should not teach them. After a quick dribble from the Nespresso machine, I'm still not quite myself. I've got a seat on the inside next to the window. I lean my head against it and study anything with words printed on it. The map of the 91 bus route as it crawls along the Boulevard Montparnasse. A poster announcing an upcoming strike and consequent bus diversion. Encouragements, not threats, to validate your tickets. I look around at my fellow passengers. They seem calm in the knowledge that they have validated their tickets as they stare at the screens of their phones, little wells of blue glowing in the thick dark of morning, tapping and swiping, tapping and swiping. A sign published by the RATP gives advice. Your telephone is precious. It may be envied. We recommend vigilance when using it in public. I look down at my own phone. It is precious. It was expensive. I will take their advice. I will be vigilant when using it. I will use it to carry out a public transport vigil and use my phone to take in the world around me, to notice all the things I would miss if I were using it the way I have been, the way they all are. I'll use the phone to look around me rather than down at its screen. Instead of taking pictures that wind up in someone else's morning feed, I'll use the phone to see the world myself. Exercise is not in style, but in vigilance. I type as fast as I can and sort out the autocorrect later. That afternoon. On the Boulevard du Montparnasse is a store called L'Espace Tabac, tobacco space. We go past it every day on the bus, L'Espace Tabac in the morning, L'Espace Tabac in the afternoon, L'Espace Tabac going one way, L'Espace Tabac the other. I remember when Paris was all tobacco space. Now it's contracted to this one store. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a man who seems to be petting an invisible animal, as if he were miming the animal being there, defining the shape of it in the air with his caressing hand. I look at him directly, and it's his suede ankle boot he's touching, running his hand over the silken piles. October 9th, 2014, Thursday morning. Everyone's up and out already, and I join them this morning. The guy in the chair upholstery shop is there with the chairs. The guy in the caterers is there receiving delivery. I walk past a man entering a porte cochere who drops his cigarette butt as I walk by, and the smell of the tobacco wafts up to me and for a moment mingles with the cold morning air, and it's like a proof of life. You don't want to get a lungful of it, just a whiff of someone else's smoke as the spark goes out. I'm glad all these people are out here doing what they're doing, and my bus comes and I perch on a backwards facing seat. Really annoyed by people who sit on the outside seat leaving the inside one empty. Unless you have a physical inability to slide over, slide the hell over, even if you're getting off soon. The person who sits on the outside will understand. It is their responsibility to understand and to get up for you, just as it is your responsibility to move over for them. Bus ethics, people, give it a try. That afternoon. There's a scruffy guy lounging over two seats who is clearly not interested in sharing, so I sit somewhere else. Then an elderly man gets on and says, "Excuse me, may I sit here, please?" And the young scruffy guy gets up and mutters, "Qu'est-ce que, putain?" By the door, as I wait for my stop, a man in a hat looks out the window and says, "Uzi." Monday afternoon, October 27th. Reading the years, and this quote is good for that Zadie article I have to write. The omnibus in which she had come, with its silent passengers looking cadaverous in the blue light, had already vanished. Wolf is usually so humanizing to the people on public transport, but this seems like she's been reading The Wasteland. I had not thought death had undone so many. Zadie is much more human about the people on the bus, much more Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown. All novels start with an old lady in the carriage opposite. Something's jiggling my arm. Jiggle, 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 jiggle. I look down. It's the child in the seat next to me, tapping away at a little red BlackBerry. I assume it's a game he's playing. I can't really tell. The sunlight makes a glare on the screen. How old is he? Not more than 9? Thursday, October 30th. The bus is on diversion, and all hell is breaking loose. But where's he going? What's he doing? What's going on? The fuck is he doing? The foment bills and bills, and I think they might rush the driver in his seat up there so he agrees to stop in unexpected places on this unexpected route. But he can't stop just anywhere. He has to stop somewhere safe. This doesn't matter to the woman who wants to get off right now, right here, and not a little ways down, and for whom it is becoming increasingly urgent to get off right away. No, right away. Can I get off here, or here, or here? Monsieur, il faut que je descende. La, 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 la! Monday morning, November 3rd. Poetics of the city as view. The only time you're at this height, not as high as the first floor, but higher than the ground. You never move quickly. It's not like a car. There's no weaving, no darting, just a progression of stops and starts. You're always going forward, the 91, then the 92, making its way along the long boulevards, which curve north or south, but never turn. The only time you see the city at this pace. You think you have a moment to take a quick picture of a caryatid, poster, yourself reflected in the windows of the building. But as soon as you've tapped and swiped over to the camera setting on the phone, the bus is moving again. Thursday afternoon, November 20th. Taught Perec today, an attempt at exhausting a place in Paris. The kids were into it. They liked thinking about how the place we look at the world from shapes the way we see it. At first, they're bogged down by all the details. They've never read anything like it. They're used to stories with plots and characters or textbooks. They haven't encountered writing like this, writing of the everyday, writing without an argument, writing that suggests, that counts, that tracks. Tomorrow I'll take them to Saint-Sulpice and they'll do the exercise for themselves, and they'll see how tough it is to notice everything, and how freeing it is to try. The one thing they notice are the buses. Perec tracked all the buses that went through the Place Saint-Sulpice those few days in 1974. I never noticed the buses so much, said one student, but now everywhere I go in the city I'm keeping track of them. Another was like, but why does he do this? I don't understand. Who does this? Who reads this? I didn't know how to answer her. That book strikes me as less a means of writing for someone and more a means of making sense of the world. Like, things are out of control. Count the buses, slow down, pattern the world. I think that's probably a good place to stop.
Thing to listen to be with you. Aww, thanks. on that bus. In Paris, in the present tense. So what was freeing about the restriction of writing on notes on the phone? Because it seemed to, I get the feeling that it really was.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's that like Ulipian idea that in constraint comes freedom. Like if you place a rubber band around what you're trying to do, then you find it actually feels really good to stretch your muscles by stretching the rubber band, and really kind of exhausting or tunneling out or hollowing out whatever it is that you've given yourself to write about. So I think, you know, the Ulipo often, I think, visits creative writing classrooms, and I, in my own creative writing classroom, have often used Ulipian exercises because I think there's something, you know, kind of terrifying about the blank page. Like, what am I going to write about if I could write about anything? But if you give yourself a place to start from, even if it's just an exercise, a way of clearing the cobwebs, or just a way of keeping yourself, you know, entertained on the bus in a more, you know, educational manner than just looking at Twitter, you know, you might come up with something that you might not have thought of otherwise if you'd been writing about anything, you know. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, of course it does. I'm sort of keeping away from Ulipo and Perec, but I think maybe I'm going to have to walk Perec in now to this conversation because he is the ghost in the book, and you know, and you write a lot about him and teach him. And obviously, I've also quoted Perec quite extensively in my own work. That idea of patterning the world to somehow for it not to be too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But we're really talking about the everyday life. We're talking about the movement of everyday life. So everyday life in movement, that's very important to this book, because it's not static. And that's what I was really trying to get at when I was talking about what did the restriction give you on the phone. I think that you know, it would be really interesting to try and write walking down the road on that, which I'm sure you did, on the phone. And then you make this really interesting point, because later on in the book, you're on the metro, and this is after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and you're on the metro, and you notice the change in your mood, the change in your own vulnerability, and you're fearful, and you notice that people on the metro read paper, and people on buses read their phones. They're on their phones. I thought we could talk about that. Is that because you know, you go down into the underworld on the metro, and you need to sort of you want other worlds apart from that one, and then on a bus you actually write in there, jammed together in the physical world, and you can look out at things through the window.
Yeah, I think that's something that I haven't come to any kind of conclusion about. What is the difference between the metro and the bus, and why are people reading books on the metro and their phones on the bus? I mean, it may be as simple as you can't get very good cell reception. I mean, you get some better than in London, or people get car sick on the bus when they try to read a book. But I'm not sure that's it. I think what you're saying is a possible explanation, that you can lose yourself in a book in a way you can't in your phone. I mean, you can kind of distract yourself with your phone, but it's not the same kind of world building exercise. And so maybe in down under there, we have to forget that we're like in a like tin can, basically hurtling through the city underground. So we have to, you know, hide in the book. I was talking to a friend today who had just had a baby, and he was saying that in the metro, there's like all these people like kind of leering and looking at them and the baby, whereas on the bus, they feel much more relaxed and people are much cooler about there being a baby in a stroller. But I think there's just different moods, different ways of being on the metro or the bus.
Yeah. So I think the difference between you and Perec is that Perec holds the reader at a distance, keeps things controlled, patterned. There's a system, there are endless lists. He's also endlessly touching. I mean, you know, when I read Perec, I'm always moved. I've never really quite understood why. But you do something else. In fact, I think you're better than Perec. I do actually. I'm just more interested in that's why, although I know that you feel very indebted to Perec, and in a way we are, I think that you bring the reader in. You do not push the reader away, and nor are you in our face. So I think that's a skill. That's hard to do. My favorite observation on the bus is the guy who's looking out of the window and sort of randomly just says, "Sarkozy."
Yep. I really like bizarre.
I really like that you don't explain it, and that it just ends there.
Who could explain it? I mean, how do you explain Sarkozy?
Sarkozy. Well, you know, in another sort of writing, maybe you would have to say, you might have to give that some, you might have to work that observation differently. But I it just rang true of buses. Sarkozy. and that's a very good tip, really. David Bowie, I'll never forget reading this interview where he said when he was stuck writing lyrics and he couldn't write the last line, the last card in his pocket was to write something with something completely overwhelmingly illogical. Mm-hmm. That moment where the man just looks out of the window and says "Sarkozy" seems somehow to be somewhere there, and also intuitively just very understandable when we think thinking about something and just say one word of the thought. Okay, so you notice what people are wearing or doing, and how people occupy public space, and why that might be political. So there are echoes of flaneurs there. Do you feel that if you were to go back, if you were going to do this again, would there be a different, would you approach that? Is there anything you've learned, in other words, from this experiment that you would do differently in another book?
Ah, it's a very good question. I mean, there are moments in the book in terms of my responses to the world that are completely different since I became a mother, for instance. There is that one scene where I see this woman with her three kids, and I'm like all judgy. She's like, one of them has a cut on its nose, and I'm like, dude, cut your kids' fingernails. They're slicing themselves up. And now I have this toddler who has very strong ideas about when I get to cut his nails. And it's not ever is the answer. So he walks around with these like fingernails, like a Long Island hairdresser. And he's gashes all over his face. So, you know, who am I to judge? I've really learned quite a bit about getting that kind of judgy thing in check. And I think that, speaking of Long Island, you know, this is like, you can take the girl out of Long Island, but you can't take that reflexive judgment of how other people are being, you know, out of the girl. I do try to be mellow.
I think that's what we do on transport. We're looking, we're judging.
Yeah, exactly.
And then just another influence is Annie Ernaux.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. In particular, you say exterior. Is it exteriors?
Exteriors, yeah.
Exteriors. Such an amazing book. Recently published in Britain by Fitzcarraldo. Mm-hmm. I think written in 1985. And Fitzcarraldo have done everything to bring a new generation of readers to Annie Ernaux. Yeah. So in exteriors, if I remember it correctly, Ernaux has moved to a new town 40 kilometers outside of Paris, and she starts to keep a journal. And again, it's what she notices, and the beginning is graffiti she's noticed, and the first line is insanity, the second line is somebody loves somebody. And then the third one that made me laugh, I don't know if this is word perfect, but if your children are communists, they will be happy. And off she goes. And then she sort of brings back a guy who works in Franprix in a supermarket. She sees him outside the supermarket with his partner, and they're choosing a camembert, and it's a président, and he's making a joke about, shall we take the président home, and he's got like punk canes, and this is only a paragraph, but I've just never forgotten that kind of journal making, you know, where you are really making a history, which he goes on to do, obviously, in the years. No finer writer. I mean, tell me about Ernaux's influence on you and conceptually on your book.
Yeah. Well, that this book would not exist without exteriors, which in French is called Journal du dehors, like journal mm-hmm. of outside, journal of outside places. And I directly cribbed her idea. I took her idea. I'm very much hoping that it will come out in French so I can send it to her, because I think her English is only so-so. And I love and revere her so much. And I just want to show her what I made. Like she's my literary mom or something. But yeah, she's wonderful. I mean, I've written about her a little bit. I first found Simple Passion in the Fnac in like 1999, and it was a skinny little book written in really easy French. And I was like, oh, cool, I'll buy this. You know, I was just learning French at that time. I think it was the first book that I ever read in French that wasn't for school. And just was taken aback by how directly she tells the story of this affair that she had with this man. And for her, the way that she valorized the first person from a woman's perspective about a guy, and just she's like admitting to sitting home and waiting for him to call. And it's not pathetic, it's not to be laughed at, but it's also not to be taken too seriously either. It really just strikes that perfect note of like, I'm writing very directly and sparely about my life, and by doing that, I am validating women's voices in general. So I was just very struck, you know, and obviously at that time in my life, I was rather preoccupied with my own love affairs, which, you know, at 20 years old were very different than the one that she was describing, which I think she was, you know, 40 or in her 40s when she wrote that book. So yeah, that was really the beginning of me reading Annie Ernaux and just really admiring the way she's not bothered about trying to show off what she knows, what she's read, what she's learned, you know, who she can reference. There's no digressions. It is a lot like Edouard Louis' writing. I think he's another young writer who's writing in Annie Ernaux's wake, but every time I read him, I feel very struck by and admiring of his ability to get out of his own way. But yeah, I think to come back to this book, there's this real sense that of what she takes in that book, what she allows to enter the book, the way that you were just describing that scene in the supermarket. She's really investing places like the supermarket or the RER or a parking lot of the supermarket with presence and meaning. Like these aren't just, you know, as I wrote about in Flaneuse, just places to kind of get through on your way to living your life somewhere else. I've written another essay about her that I think is going to be out in Literary Hub soon. Saying that she's kind of doing the opposite of what Marc Auger called the non-lieu, like the non-space. She's saying, no, these are not non-spaces. They are real spaces with real people living their lives in them. And we have to kind of give credit to that and honor that.
Definitely. I think I should say at this point to the audience that we're going to be taking questions. So please do feel free to ask Lauren the questions in the Q&A, which is going to be in about 10 minutes. I think Claire is going to filter those through. Let's just, maybe we could just have a short second reading, Lauren.
Yeah,
a little
sure.
bit further. Yeah, a little bit further on in the book, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll do a little bit. So, Another, one of the two kind of plot moments in the book are the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and then yeah. I got pregnant back then. So this yeah. is a little bit about being pregnant back then. This is March 20th, 2015, Friday afternoon. Suddenly, the world is full of strollers. I pay attention to the way the parents angle them up and into the buses. I take note of who goes where, how they slide into their parking spaces, how the parents hit the brake to immobilize them, how they keep their kids quiet, how they stop them licking the walls of the bus. There are so many things to know now. March 24th, Tuesday morning. So far, not a single man has given up his seat for me, my friend Jay said when she came to town 6 months pregnant. The only people who stand for me are women. That afternoon, I'm exhausted from growing a human and the buses are slow. Couldn't wait 14 minutes for the next 92, so I jumped in a cab. Follows my bus all the way home. I get off at my stop. Wednesday afternoon, March 25th. Sometimes I get the bus for one stop now. I lean against the railing in the handicapped area and contemplate this new reality. Everything smells so intense, like it's all been sprayed with a perfume of its own scent, like the smells are in high definition, if high definition could make you want to hurl. Thursday morning, March 26th. Paris sent la merde ce matin, pas vrai? Thursday night, March 26th. There are a lot of people on the tram. Friday afternoon, March 27th. The bus is on diversion. The driver breaks the fourth wall to tell us. Then so do the passengers, consulting and commiserating with each other, whereas 10 minutes ago they pretended they were invisible. All of us departing from convention. March 31st, Tuesday morning. You never see people begging on the bus. Taking the bus, you only see a certain kind of person. There's some women who just to look at them makes you think they smell like cigarettes and heavy secret smells and would get eye makeup all over your pillow. These women I often see on the bus. That afternoon. The bus is full and I have to stand. A little girl is standing next to me, her head at my hip. She looks up at me, then begins to play with the frayed place in the thigh of my jeans. She's singing a little song that goes, hello, hello, then I can't understand the rest of the words. She looks up to see if I mind her playing with the loose threads on my jeans. Hello, I say brightly in English and scare her. Stop there.
Yeah, because the book then changes its mood and becomes... we go somewhere else because you become pregnant. We have a pregnant body in public space and on the bus, and then you lose that pregnancy, and you write about that so magnificently. You tell us that an ectopic pregnancy, or ectopic means to be out of place, and you follow that thought with a red bag. A man in a very small suit is wearing a red tote bag, and you feel that this is somewhat out of place. So you chase that, and we begin to feel that this journey becomes really much more epic. Over time, with a pregnancy, the loss of a pregnancy, and then Charlie Hebdo, and you then write this, Lauren. The hardest thing to make sense of was how, in an instant, the everyday can become an event. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I wrote that, I think that's from the introduction. That was like a good year after all of this had happened. And the attacks of November 13th, 2015 at the Bataclan and around the Canal Saint-Martin had happened by then. So, you know, it really hammered home, that last set of events really hammered home this feeling that I'd had for quite some time, which probably began on September 11th when I was in New York and, you know, watched the towers fall with my own eyes. That, you know, what seems like an everyday day when you get out of bed and go to work can become an event with a capital E, and you just never know when that's going to happen. And I started having panic attacks on buses and on metros after the November 13th attacks, because I realized it wasn't that I was afraid. It was on the metro specifically. I wasn't afraid of like being on the metro necessarily. I was afraid of where we might be going, what might be at the end of the track. And so, yeah, I've almost lost the thread of what I was trying to say because it's so like bouleversant.
Your diary entries become much longer. They need to.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Well, we've got some questions coming in, and let's go for some of them here. This is anonymous. You managed to write a book while being on the bus. Could the bus be the new room of one's own?
A room you're sharing with a bunch of other people who maybe are writing books. Yeah, I think in this day and age, when you don't have your $500 a year from whatever rich relative died and left it to you, you've got to go and make your living teaching or being a barista or doing whatever you got to do. Definitely.
Okay. Another anonymous. Was your phone just a receptacle for your observations, or did the act of noting everything down make you more observant over time?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I think that this book very much grew out of Flaneuse, because I had just finished writing that when I started keeping this journal. And, I don't know, it's like from the old cartoons, like Bugs Bunny, he's running, he runs, maybe it's no, Roadrunner, running, he runs right off the cliff, and then he's like, and he falls. So I feel like this book is that part after I ran off the cliff, and, the falling, whatever, I was okay, I dusted myself off. But, it's like I was so used to running and noticing and looking at the world around me and getting it all down in print that when I stopped doing Flaneuse, but then I just kept doing the thing that Flaneuse had taught me to do.
Mm. And we also have to say that you are Dr. Elkin. You're a trained critical thinker. So, I think that you are exceptionally good, Lauren, at that kind of note-taking.
Roadrunner analogies.
Absolutely. And here's Fiona Melrose. Hi, Fiona. Fiona asks, thank you for your books. I'm interested in how Lauren thinks this book would be different in form, say, in London or Berlin, another large city. What does Paris bring to this exercise form, and how you experienced it?
I think that's a wonderful question. Thank you, Fiona. I ask myself this question all the time. I'm thinking particularly of a really wonderful academic book by Michael Sheringham called, I think it's just called Everyday Life, but it's about how at mid-century and a little bit after in Paris, all of these writers started getting really interested in what was going on in everyday life. Michel de Certeau, Georges Perec, Annie Ernaux, Jacques Tati, there's like no end of creative people being inspired by, life on the streets of Paris. And arguably that has a very long history, which I won't get into now. But there's something about Paris that makes you look outward and look at other people. And I said this recently in an essay that it's a city where the cafe tables have the chairs positioned, not so that you can look at the person you're with, but so you can look out at the people walking by. Maybe I was trained by living in Paris to start to look around me. Maybe that's something that I wouldn't have done if I'd stayed in New York. Certainly something that I learned from reading Perec and from reading Ernaux. I haven't lived in Berlin and I'm only just moving to London, so I don't really know how it would be different elsewhere. But all I can say is that in Paris, I feel kind of cradled by the city and the people who live there and given permission to look at them. They're my people, but they're not my people. I've lived there for 20 years, but I'm not, from there. So I'm close enough to feel like I deserve to be aggravated by them and like I've earned the fact to love the place and to adore the place. I've paid my dues. So I don't know, there's something for me personally about that closeness but distance that is very productive as a writer.
Yeah, and early on in the book, you're writing about applying for French citizenship and asking yourself why you want it. And so all these kind of everyday questions that are much bigger questions about authorship and identity and all of that seem to be that the smallness of the form of the actual iPhone, I mean, mm-hmm. the screen of the iPhone, mm-hmm. What fascinates me is it's just the themes are so epic in that small physical space, but are intellectually mm-hmm. and socially so big. We've got another question here. I'm interested in the way that having a pattern to write in or through helped you to understand, process the events that happen. Oh, sorry, helped you to understand, yeah. process the events that happen, if it did.
I really think it, yeah, I think there's a direct correlation. I mean, it's why people keep diaries, right? It's the impulse to write out what's happening to you. You know, it's kind of, I don't know, you know, if you could think back to childhood and the things you wrote down in your journal, it would either be like, had a sandwich today, mom took me to the store, or be like, I hate Kenny so much when he steals my pencils. You know, it's either like the banal or like the thing that really fires you up and gets you going. And there's something about the act of journaling from a very young age. I'm not quoting my own journals, don't worry. Something about the act of journaling, it's, I guess, like the, you know, a written version of therapy, right? It's a form of taking in what the world has given you and then spitting it back out again helps you, as you say, you know, process it in a very kind of mechanical manner. It's something I think that's very important, just to not take things in and then hold them inside, but, you know, we need to get them back out again in whatever form that takes. I was not going to therapy at this time, though maybe I should have been. But if I had been, maybe I wouldn't have written this book.
This is a great question from Sarah Duff. This is probably a silly question, but how does nausea factor into this book? I get terrible motion sickness on buses and can't read anything on them. That said, I'm reading this book, although while sitting
just
still.
Just not on the bus. Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for that. Nausea is an issue when I got pregnant, but it wasn't really before. I don't know why. I get terrible motion sickness as well, but for some reason on the bus, it's not a problem. But when I'm sitting backwards, that's when I really, that's, yeah, I think I might mention that a couple of times, that I can't really read or write when I'm sitting backwards.
Yeah. Okay. This is Alison Timmons. If Simone de Beauvoir had been on that bus with you, what do you think he would make of modern Paris?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. What would Simone de Beauvoir make of modern Paris? God, I think she'd love it. She'd be thrilled. I mean, she might be kind of skeptical of the like Americanization of Paris. I think that's something that you hear French people complain about a lot. I think contemporary Paris is trying to be Brooklyn or something, or you know, Hackney, and it really needs to stop. Like, enough with the new Paris already. So I think she'd probably be like, you know, what's with all the filament light bulbs, and you know, why are there metro tiles on all the walls? But yeah, I think she'd be probably, you know, pleased at the energy and happy to be alive. However many years it is now after her death.
She might be shocked that she can't sit in cafes for the entire day, like, and write as she did in her own era, you know.
Exactly.
That or maybe she could. Maybe she would still be given a special room, you know, in Cafe Flore, and she could write there from 9 till 6 with an interruption of lunch with Sartre, mm-hmm. Who I think was given his own phone line back in the day in Café Flore. I wonder what she'd think of the clothes, because she was really interested in clothes, as are we all, and as are you. I love your descriptions of clothes, of what people are wearing on the bus. I like the tutu and the... Mm-hmm. The fake lashes. I love your attention on the pleats of a coat and thinking, well, they don't work. Let's find Another question. That's a great question about Simone de Beauvoir on the bus. I'm always interested in the moral element of thinking about how we pay attention. Earlier, Lauren said, quote, it was more educational to take notes than scroll Twitter. How do you make sense of those questions in your own life?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know that I myself personally think that it's more, you know, educational. I think I meant to say edifying, but, you know, slip of the tongue. I don't know that I believe it's more edifying to write my silly little notes on my phone than to read Twitter. Like, sometimes they're great. There's, you know, great stuff on Twitter. But yeah, I think I was probably referencing a general perspective that one is wasting one's time on social media. And, you know, I definitely think that social media has this way of both provoking us and placating us at the same time. You know, the scroll is happening so quickly and you've got people who are like trying to get you to engage. They're like, you know, posting things like, you know, I just saw something today. Someone said, like, what's something you would say during sex? And of course, people are like, oh, I'm going to tell you right away what like witty thing I think it would be funny to say during sex. Or you have people with their ridiculous trolling attitudes. Or, you know, there's something about this sheer mountain of verbiage coming at you that just makes you kind of glaze over and just like look at it. And so I think that's what I was fighting against in writing this book and taking these notes and what I said just before. I think we have to kind of do what we can when we're awake enough and in the mood enough. We have to do what we can to bestir ourselves to take note of the world around us and, you know, what people are doing and how they're living and how they're making meaning together on a bus, on the street, in the supermarket. I think it's not just like edifying or educational, but, you know, ethical to pay attention to things and to people. And I think it's the job of the writer to teach people how to do that.
Mm. Yeah. And you also write so beautifully about what you consider to be the sound of the 21st century, which is tap, tap, tap on the phone. You've described it as the sound, the sort of tap, tap, scroll, tap, tap, scroll. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that is the sound of the 21st century. I don't know.
It's hard to hear.
It is hard to hear, but there is a sort of, but you do hear it. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is Carolyn Maguire. What makes a particular piece of your own writing become meaningful for you and makes it get beyond the editing process? So how does it get through the editing process? You know, what makes it meaningful?
I think I'm thinking in terms of what makes something meaningful to other people. So I have an ear out for what seems like self-pitying or like with a real kind of agenda that's not an interesting agenda. It's hard to even clarify what I mean by that. Sometimes a slightly uninteresting agenda can be edited to be a more interesting agenda. But yeah, I think I came of age during the blogging years, you know, of the early noughties when everybody was just like vomiting forth prose left, right, and center. I guess now people have newsletters, but I don't have the time for newsletters. I think, you know, having a kid and kind of basically means you have to decide what you're going to read. And for me, newsletters are mostly out, even though some I love and I would love to be able to read. But I think, you know, being of age during the time of blogging gave me a better eye for what was interesting in people's writing, because you've got like vast amounts of prose and it kind of trained me to be an editor and look for like the good moments, you know, what was really like what the zingers or something. And so in this book, I think there's a lot of like stuff that I might ordinarily leave out, like that whole little complainy spiel that I included about like slide the hell over, you know, that's the kind of thing that I would like bitch about to my partner or something, like slide the hell over, but it's not something I would necessarily think to include in a piece of writing. But I let it stand here because hopefully there's enough other interesting stuff that, you know, you can forgive me for it. And maybe it's interesting because it's like you're on the bus with me and I'm complaining to you. So, you know, there's definitely an element of like, I've left stuff in that might be cringy that I might otherwise take out. But, you know, it's kind of part of the experiment of the book. Just leave it in and see how it feels. And so when I was reading it just then, it felt a bit like a monologue or something. So maybe, you know, it's character building rather than like essayistic writing, if that makes any sense.
I think it would be pretty odd to be on a bus and not have those thoughts slide the hell over. Don't tread on my toes. I mean, you know, bad news. I think also the thing about editing, I don't know about you, Lauren, but after a long stretch of writing, when you earn that edit, you know, because we sort of edit all the time because speaking for myself, I'm writing on a laptop and you lose count of how many drafts you do because you're kind of correcting things all the time. But on the whole, if you do a fairly long stretch of writing and a free writing, there is that moment, you know, when you're gonna do an edit. And I find that I have all kinds of rituals for that edit. I make a small coffee. I open the windows. It's like the moment that you're just going to somehow compose, you know, this work. And it's not just the terrible stuff that goes. It's also pretty good stuff that goes. I have this sort of weirdly destructive thing, whereas I don't actually save. If there's a paragraph that I like a lot, but has completely derailed the work, I don't put in offcuts, I just delete it. And I hope, I do. And I just sort of hope that somehow it will return to me when it needs, you know, in the right place, not this one.
Oh,
here is Paul Tickle. Is the Paris bus, like its London equivalent, a more working class mode of transport than the tube or metro? Only losers take the bus as, oh, Paul, your question has just disappeared from my screen. Here it's come back. Only losers take the bus as the Fatima Mansions song goes. When you mention the Long Island in you, is that a class reference?
Is that the question? Is it a class reference? Okay.
That's the question.
Interesting. Well, first of all, I'm American, so no, it's not a class reference. It's a regional reference. And there might be some encoded class reference when I said like a Long Island hairdresser's nails about my son's nails, but because it's a much gentler society in terms of class structure, or maybe we're fooling ourselves and it's just as bad as in the UK. For me, that wasn't like a dig at a Long Island hairdresser. It's more just, you know, an evocation of what their nails might look like. But yeah, I think, and I sort of said this recently in an interview, someone asked me if I would do a Liverpool equivalent of this book, because I've just been living in Liverpool for a few years. And I said, really, no, I wouldn't, because, you know, in Paris, it is a very like middle-class thing to take the bus. Everybody takes the bus. Lots of people from all different walks of life take the bus. But in Liverpool, it really is people who can't afford to drive who do. I mean, there are like people who only have one car and their partner has it for the day who are on the bus, but mostly it's people who don't drive, who don't have cars, or in, you know, some sort of state of disability or I don't know. You see some like very disturbed people on the bus in Liverpool. And so, yeah, I think there is a real, I don't know London buses all that well, but I think that there is a real difference in terms of who takes the bus. And it was only in riding the bus in Liverpool that I began to understand what Margaret Thatcher said about how, you know, anyone over the age of 30 taking the bus can consider themselves a failure, which I think is possibly where that lyric that you're talking about, only losers take the bus, comes from.
Lauren, one final question from me, because we're going to have to close the shop soon.
Yeah.
Thank you for your amazing book. Thank you to the audience for such interesting questions. This is a book to treasure and to read everywhere. And I wondered if you can play us out with a short and final reading from number 91, 92, Notes on a Parisian Commute.
So I will read one last paragraph, but I just want to thank you, Deborah, for your extremely generous and wonderful and inspiring response to this book and for your words about my work. And a thank you to everyone who's come tonight and has listened and, you know, has bought the book and engaged with the book. It really, all of this means quite a lot to me. I feel very, very emotional right now in a way that I don't usually in these sorts of things. So thank you very much. And thanks to the LRB for inviting us and for hosting. So yeah, this is actually from the end of the introduction. So I will just read this short paragraph and then we'll sign off and say goodbye. Over time, the event weaves into the everyday. People we see on the bus may have been at the Bataclan or know someone who was. The woman in the corner may have had a miscarriage last month. Other people are an immense mystery. We cannot right-click on them and download their history. We do not know where they have been or where they're going. But that they are going together while companionably ignoring one another seems of paramount importance. I believe this is called community. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a hacer tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.